reached a record high, which has not been done in 27 years. How will the Brits deal with this, which includes a high cost of living? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what the UK government can do to deal with this economic challenge. This is while there's really no government in place in order to tackle this head on. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight first. Historian and journalist Tony Gosselin joins us from Bristol. Also joining us, economist and author Steve Keen, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Steve Keen, let me first start with you and get an idea about this warning from the Bank of England. It's not obviously, it's pretty bad in its content. A recession to last until next year, which you can tell us the definition would be five consecutive quarters of a contraction, each quarter to be 3 months in duration. Tell us more about that and how the Bank of England can be so sure into the future that the UK is going to be experiencing this inflation or recession.
They can be fairly sure about the inflation as for the level of contraction. Did you say five quarters then?
Is it
five quarters of negative growth?
Isn't that what it is until next year?
That's the length of time. The usual, like the informal definition of a recession is two consecutive negative quarters. To get five is a serious recession. So I think it's quite feasible that these sorts of falls are going to occur because we've had two major forces that kept the economy ticking during COVID. One was enormous government deficits, which generate an identical private sector surplus, giving people money to spend, which they did, which is why the recession was so short-lived. Now the government's talking about trying to balance its books, which is a stupid thing for the government to be focusing upon, but if they do reduce the size of the deficit, they also reduce the amount of money they're injecting into private bank accounts. People have less money and there's a downturn there. And then with higher interest rates, which are now passing through to mortgages, credit cards and so on, that higher cost of money is going to discourage people from taking out credit. So rather than credit going very strongly, as it did also during the COVID boom, we could now see credit turning negative. And that's what caused the Great Recession or the global financial crisis back in 2008. So we're going to get potentially a double whammy of a government-induced recession from high rates and from cutting back on its spending on top of a private sector, one caused by a reduction in credit.
Okay. What we are also seeing here, Tony Gosselin, not to get too, I guess, technical in a sense, is that we're seeing how the household incomes are not keeping up, in a sense, with the inflation. So they don't have that purchasing power. And that is going to obviously have a dent not only on the economy, but also just in terms of the quality of life that people are going to be experiencing based on what we are looking at. And, inflation the Bank of England says it's going to peak at 13.5%. But people are having a really hard time as we speak. Tell us how this is going to pan out when it comes to just people's lives in terms of what is being now announced by the Bank of England.
Well, look, Steve Keen has just explained what's going on very, very in a very, very concise fashion there. I think what we need to understand, though, is that something really big is going on. It reminds me very much of the West's reaction, the NATO countries' reaction to the Russians going into Ukraine. Is the actual solution to this, the Bank of England increasing interest rates, seems to be almost designed to make the problem worse. There's something very perverse seems to be happening. I think we're basically at war, is an economic war taking place, and that war is between traditional, sane, sensible forms of industrial capitalism, where the government acts as a kind of mediator and the central banks act as mediators in order to ensure that there's no ability for private interests to profiteer and to get into infrastructure, where basically they just sit back and reel in as much money and start price fixing as much as they want. And this new form, well, it's newer form of capitalism, which is finance capitalism, which basically means money is your god. And you can do anything with that money. If you can bribe your way into a government office and take over a government service, you can do it. And that's the war which is going on in Britain at the moment. And it does seem as if the finance capitalists are winning here. But Steve and I are both, you will see neither of us on British television talking about this. This is, of course, what British people and policymakers need to hear. And so that's interesting in itself that we are completely shut out of that debate. I have to thank you at Press TV for even allowing this to take place that the British people can then start to see. Anyway, beyond that, you asked me about what the British people are going to be doing over this. And I've been talking to rail workers today who are having a particularly hard time. And having a little chat to them, it's quite obvious to me that what's going on is... Sorry, I've lost your connection completely. Sorry.
No problem. While you fix that, let me come to you, Steve Keen. This fall in living standards is said to be the longest and deepest fall on record. And it's the way it was described, that one of the biggest reasons for that are the energy bills that are set to triple. Triple. I mean, that's a lot. How does that translate for households that can't afford to, for example, pay it? You know what I mean? What was going to happen?
Yeah. Well, there are people who already were very close to the red line in the UK. The low-income earners in the UK, I don't know how they survived, frankly. Given my own background, I was earning about £90,000 a year when I was in London, which it ended up being £4,000 a month, and half of that went in my accommodation, and the remainder had to go on living. And I found it challenging compared to the same income back in Australia, where I was quite comfortable. That I know first-year teachers, first-year nurses, first-year firemen, and so on, are on wages between £20,000 and £25,000 a year. Now, they can't even imagine living in London, and the cost for them in the rest of the country were already high. Trebling the cost of energy is going to mean for a lot of those people they will not be able to afford energy, and they will therefore have to consider things like wearing gloves inside their own homes to avoid freezing during winter. And they certainly can't do anything to fight the increase in temperature when you get the enormous temperatures that are coming through courtesy of global warming now. London recording, England recording 40 degrees, which is literally unheard of in its historic record. So they're going to suffer very badly. And I think there's going to be an enormous amount of angst out of this and lots of strike action over it, but very little chance to change the direction of the government policy and very little chance to increase their wages as well.
But why not? Why wouldn't the government change its policy?
The government has been following the wrong policy for 40 years. It's very unlikely to wake up, oh dear, we've been doing it wrongly, let's do it the right way now. They still think the government should be behaving like a household and trying to save money every year. Now, the government is not a household. No other household that I know of has the right to create money, but the government does. So if the government creates money, that money turns up in our bank accounts, and that requires the government to run a deficit. Now, the English government has been obsessed by running a surplus. Looking at the accounting of the economy from just their point of view and thinking if they pay a surplus, they can pay their debt down and they see that as responsible. But because what happens with the government is the mirror image of what happens with the non-government, if the government runs a surplus of $1 trillion, the private sector runs a deficit of $1 trillion. We're not talking about numbers that high, but fundamentally it's a seesaw. One's up, the other's down. The average is zero. So if the government is trying to save money, it's causing the private sector to dissave. Now, they've been doing that nonetheless for 40 years. They still haven't woken up. I really have no confidence that they will ever wake up over this. So they're doing the wrong thing, and yet they think they're doing the right thing. Humans' capacity to self-delude cannot be underestimated.
Uh-huh. So the lesson I'm learning from you here, and hopefully the viewers, is that the government shouldn't have a surplus because that money should actually be flowing into the people, average people, to take out and spend into the economy. So having a surplus is not... great idea. Okay, so the cost of living crisis, Tony Gosling, this is what the Bank of England has said, that it's going to continue throughout next year and only begin to ease in the year 2024. And then, of course, along with that, the UK economy contracting for all this time. 2024 is 2022. The timeline there is so long. How are people going to survive?
No, I know, but you see, the thing is, these predictions by the Bank of England have a rather nasty habit of in a couple of years' time, they say, well, sorry, we got that wrong. It's going to be continuing even beyond that, this recession. I mean, I think really what we're looking at here is a deliberate sabotaging of the economy. The thing is that there are people that benefit from this. You have to understand this is how finance capitalism works. What they do is they wreck countries and then they pick up the pieces for next to nothing, and that's what they're doing to Britain now. Many of these Anglo-Zionist empire great financiers have been doing this around the world. They've been wrecking countries and then buying up for cheap. And also, of course, they make a lot of money on these reconstruction contracts. And one of the big effects of the enormous green taxes that have been being put onto fuel here in Britain is that it's driving small firms out of business, many small firms. In Bristol, we've been checking out the tax which is being put onto people. They say it's a clean air tax, but against their own figures, of 40 micrograms of nitrogen dioxide per square meter. This is the amount that they use to measure whether it's a dangerous level or not. The Bristol figures are actually below that level as an average through the year, which is what the government has said. And yet they're imposing this new toll, effectively. That's what it is anyway. The super rich don't pay the toll because they all have brand new cars, which don't pay the toll. And even disabled people have to pay these tolls. So what we're really looking at is an embattled criminal elite, I think. And their plans are failing around the world. Their economic plans are failing. And so they're turning on their own population and seeing them now as a kind of milch cow in order to squeeze them for as much wealth as out of them as they possibly can. And when they collapse these small businesses, this of course, plays into the hands of the giants like Amazon, who I noticed, by the way, today in Britain, we've had one of the first proper strikes at Amazon, where all of the Amazon workers who were offered 35 pence pay increases, you know, tiny amounts of money by the company, have just downed tools. And at one point, actually, they were locked up illegally within the workplace and they couldn't leave. So this is what we're dealing with. I think a fascistic system where, and I use that word advisedly, because this is fascism. When big corporations think they can rule the roost, do what they want without any kind of recourse to government or law, they just see then the legal actions against them as a cost of doing business. And so they just do what they want. And that's what I think we're seeing. These big companies now think, well, the more small businesses we can ruin and destroy, the bigger our control of the markets will be. And that's, you're quite right to point out at the beginning that we're in this kind of interregnum here in Britain where Boris has gone. We've got probably a couple of people possibly taking over, most likely Liz Truss, who is a total puppet. So there is no real government, you're quite right. And the big corporations love it like that. The big oil companies, the energy companies have just brought in record profits more than ever before. They are basically running the show here, and the people are cannon fodder to them.
Okay, well, let's look at the reasons that have been cited, first of all, how this has been described, Steve Keen. High inflation, low growth, soaring energy bills, and it's been described as the main driver behind that overall is the Ukraine conflict. Now, do you agree that this is just because of the Ukraine conflict? I mean, was UK's economy doing well before the Ukraine conflict, or were there remnants prior to that?
There are basically three major factors that are coming together all at once. One is that we have pushed, we've ignored the warning of the limits to growth 50 years ago and continued pushing our energy consumption. So now we're consuming probably four times as much as we were back in 1972. And that means we've exhausted cheap oil. We're now exhausting even unconventional oil. So the cost of energy is rising, and that's inevitably going to continue happening. We, at the same time, we have had a period of extended low inflation courtesy of globalization. So particularly American corporations, but also UK corporations, have outsourced manufacturing to China, which reduced costs dramatically for a long, long time, but also made the manufacturing sector very fragile because there's an enormous supply chain. And if that gets disrupted at any point, then costs rise. And of course, COVID has dramatically disrupted the supply chain, particularly from China. Then we have this period of ongoing austerity by governments where they falsely believe they should save money, but rather than saving money, what they're doing is creating not enough money, and therefore the economy grows more slowly because of a lack of government of money for turnover. So those three factors are all coming together at once, and the most important one, I think, for the long term is a rising cost of production. And in that situation, if you want to squeeze inflation out of the economy, there's only two other factors you can affect. You can reduce wages, which are already at trivial levels in the UK, or you can reduce the markups that firms put on their input costs. And that is something which the firms have resisted for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Now, the interest rates are likely to increase the cost of business, not reduce it. So I think the government is finding out how impotent it is now with the tools it's chosen to use.
The 2008 financial crisis, obviously, Tony Gosling, had a very deep effect and impact not only across the world but also on the UK. Now, this one, which has been described as a recession that's going to last, it's the longest downturn since the 2008 financial crisis. And the way that one analyst has described it is that it's going to be as deep. It's not set to be as deep as 14 years ago, but it's going to last just as long. My question is, do you agree? And do you think that, according to some, that the UK actually did it claw itself out of the 2008 financial crisis all the way, or is it still experiencing it?
Well, look, I'm sure Steve would agree that the reaction to the 2008 bailouts, I mean, this was really where massive amounts of public money went to save zombie banks, and they shouldn't really have done. They should have just simply been allowed to collapse. But what happened there was the end of capitalism. It was the death of capitalism, because what happened, what they did is they resurrected these banks that should have just been allowed to collapse. And what that's done is it's now compounding the problem again and again. What we're seeing is governments, in fact, there was an enormous bailout during the COVID crisis, as people may know, just before the COVID crisis in 2019, which the COVID crisis was quite successfully hid. And so we're not getting the proper figures about how much public money is going into propping up these dead and dying banks. And that's, I think, what's going on. And actually, on the ground here, what we've got, of course, is we've got people's living standards being eroded in all sorts of ways, particularly through these rising energy prices, which I'm not sure, as Steve suggested there, is just part of a market force that's going on. There are enormous green taxes now coming in. We've got something in Britain called the RTFO, which went up 20 pence a litre on diesel and petrol over Christmas. But the fuel companies actually covered that up by dropping their price the same day by an equivalent amount. So there's a sneaky bringing in of these so-called green taxes into fuel. And one of the things that Boris did before he went back in 2021 was actually to refuse this new increase, these green taxes, in the cabinet, saying that, well, hang on, because this is going to cause inflation. Well, of course, it has caused inflation. But the thing is, they did it anyway. They basically ignored the what was the discussion in cabinet, and parts of the government, the Department for Transport, the Treasury, colluded with the big oil companies to bring the taxes in anyhow. So there are all sorts of reasons for this, but the main problem is that people's living standards are being eroded. That's why we're seeing industrial action on the railways, which is the biggest union in the country, who actually represent the left in Britain. They represent the political opposition to the Tory party, really, because the Labour Party is simply doing absolutely nothing about all this. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. That is to say, people simply saying, getting organised and simply saying, well, we refuse to work if you're going to be, destroying our jobs and also eroding our ability to pay. But look, the long and short of this is, in a nutshell, is this is the Great Reset. I believe that is exactly what's going on here. This is what was talked about in 2020 and 21 by the World Economic mm-hmm. Forum. What they really want to do is to collapse the economy and replace it with their own version. So this is what's called disaster capitalism. This is what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism. But they're doing it on their own people now. They've been doing it around the world for years. Now they've turned on their own kind.
That was discussed at the WEF. Do you agree with this, Steve Keen, that this is the Great Reset?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. I've met quite a few of the people that are supposed to be running this conspiracy, and they couldn't plan lunch. Okay? The extent to which people think a conspiracy is causing all this, yes, of course, these people are conspiring. Yes, of course, they're trying to get outcomes that suit themselves. Do they understand the system they're managing? Not in the slightest. So they end up causing catastrophes, and what you get is the disaster to another, and they try to maneuver their way through. They've got more power, of course, than a worker or a member of a trade union has, so they can come out on top as a result of it. But to put this down as a result of some sort of plan, as I said, they couldn't plan lunch. So I think it's ridiculous to blame it on a conspiracy, but to correct it, blame on people being in charge of a system they don't understand, and it's being fitted by hit by forces they have ignored for 50 years, the limits of growth in particular, the wrong way to run monetary policy, bring it all together. I could use lots of very colourful terms here to describe what's going on, but none of them involve a power elite knowing what they're doing.
Well, we need to find out, not we, the UK and the incoming administration, whoever's going to be the PM, needs to figure out what to do. Is there a game plan? Tony Gosling, 30 seconds.
Well, what they need to do, I think, is to bring most of the infrastructure of the country, including the railways, etc., into public ownership. And they can do that very easily, very cheaply, by just simply not renewing franchises. This is happening naturally anyway. For example, on the railways, we've had several of the companies that have been running regional railways collapse anyway, and the government's had to take them in hand themselves. But those organisations, including, by the way, I think, finance needs to be seen as a public utility, as it is in China and Russia and places like that, where the core of the financial system is managed by the government. That's why we elect them, in order to run the country.
Okay.
The worst thing in the world is when all these private businesses take these over. This was started by Thatcher, of course. We need to renationalize these things.
Very well. Thank you for that, Tony Gosling from Bristol, historian and journalist. Steve Keen from London, thank you, economist and author. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batawe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Qala fir'aun wa ma rabbul alamin.
Said Pharaoh, and what is the Lord of the world?
قال رب السماوات والأرض وما بينهما إن كنتم موقنين.
Moses said, The Lord of the heavens and earth and that between them, if you should be convinced.
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we have discussed up to 23rd verse of chapter Shu'ara. In this verse, Fir'aun, as the Holy Quran states, says, قَالَ فِرْعَوْنُ وَمَا رَبُّ الْعَالَمِينَ Pharaoh says, and what is the Lord of the worlds? And Moses answers him, قَالَ رَبُّ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا إِن كُنْتُم مُوقِنِينَ He said, He is the Lord of the heavens and the earth, and what is between them, if you have faith. So, in the previous verses, as you may remember, Prophet Moses was ordered by the Almighty Allah to go to Pharaoh. He goes to Pharaoh. Pharaoh asks him a couple of questions, and also emphasizes on the fact that you were raised as a child in our palace, and this is a ni'mah, this is a mercy and favor from my side. And now you're here to invite me to monotheism, you're here to claim that I am not the Lord in this universe. Now, Moses answers him with a decisive one. He says, this is not a favor. This is not a ni'mah. You were the reason why I was deprived of my mother's house and I was raised in your palace. And this is not what we can call a favor and mercy. Now, Pharaoh says, what is the Lord of the world? قَالَ فِرْعَوْنُ وَمَا رَبُّ الْعَالَمِينَ The point is that we can understand from what the answer is, قَالَ رَبُّ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ, that Moses, عَلَى نَبِيِّنَا وَأَلْهِ وَعَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ, implies that Pharaoh's question is not for understanding, and he was beating about the bush. If Pharaoh really sought the truth, he would understand his unity and lordship by thinking and pondering over the current order and system of the creation. Anyway, Pharaoh says, what is the Lord of the worlds? He questions Moses, who had said his Lord, the Lord of the worlds, appointed him as one of the messengers. And as the Holy Quran declares, Pharaoh says, what is the Lord of the worlds? It seems very unlikely that Pharaoh has raised this question for understanding the matter. But it rather seems that he said it out of ignorance for the sake of scoffing. I assume the reason why Pharaoh starts to question the Lord of the world is that Prophet Moses answers Pharaoh's questions and words very decisively and strongly, and Pharaoh got hopeless from this aspect, so he somehow changes the course of the conversation. Now, in this verse, وَمَا رَبُّ الْعَالَمِينَ, like all aware and attentive discussers, Moses has no way but to treat the matter earnestly and to answer it seriously. In view of the fact that the essence of Allah is out of reach of man's thought and perceptions, Moses used this sign and these effects that are everywhere in the universe, and he somehow speaks about extrovertive signs, and he says, قَالَ رَبُّ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ He said, He is the Lord of the heavens and the earth, وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا And what is between them, if you have faith. إِن كُنْتُمْ مُوقِنِينَ Nation products. على مر الزمان تألقا
وأضاء للدنيا طريقا We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, since Moses thought that his question was not for understanding, but he had no way but to answer it, he goes to talk about the signs and the effects that are visible in the universe. So he says that he is the Lord of the heavens. You can see the heavens. وَالْأَرْضِ He is the Lord of the earth. وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا You can see what is between the heavens and the earth. If you have faith, you can believe. The heavens with their greatness, the earth with its vastness and its various creatures, before which Pharaoh's kingdom is nothing, is only one part of the creation of the Lord of Moses and Lord of Pharaoh. Such a creator, such a deviser and administrator, namely Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, deserves worshipping, and not a weak and tiny creature like Pharaoh can claim to be at his place. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Mourners in Karachi commemorated the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussain's youngest child, who was not spared by the enemy forces.
The 6-month-old Ali Azhar, the youngest son of Imam Hussain, was martyred by the forces of Yazid, the Battle of Karbala, and Imam Hussain's sacrifices for righteousness and freedom are still a source of inspiration for Muslims around the world.
Mothers who brought their babies along paid tribute to Ali Asghar on the first Friday of the Islamic month of Muharram and mourned the 6-month-old son of Imam Hussain.
What had the 6-month-old done?
We are out on the streets recalling the message of that innocent child of Imam Hussein, that we will always stand against the tyrant of the time. We will always stand shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed, no matter what.
Special eulogies and rituals were performed to commemorate the incident where Ali Asghar was killed with an arrow shot in his throat in the plains of the Iraqi city of Karbala.
We are commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of Ali Asghar, the youngest martyr of Karbala, who teaches us the lessons of readiness and sacrifice in the face of injustice and brutality.
Ali Asghar was martyred while he was in the arms of his father Imam Hussein, who was pleading for water to quench the thirst of his little baby. The grandson of Prophet Muhammad and his companions sacrificed their lives but refused to pledge allegiance to the unjust Umayyad Caliph Yazid. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Prayers, storytelling, and tearful rhythmic chanting are all expected when Shia Muslims begin their annual Muharram commemorations across the globe. Shia Muslims mourn the first 10 days of the Islamic month of Muharram, remembrance of the martyrdom of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson Imam Hussein, who was unjustly slain by an oppressive tyrant some 1,400 years ago.
It isn't only in the East that you witness the mass commemoration of Imam Hussein's legacy, but also a growing community in the West, particularly of Shia Muslim converts, are benefiting tremendously from the story of Imam Hussein.
We spoke to one convert who explained to us why he felt Shia Islam was the ideal faith for him.
That's what I did like about the following of the Ahlul Bayt, because I could see in the condition of black people in the past, we suffered quite a lot. In the past, and when you look at the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, it's there too, that they see people suffering and they didn't like it in their time. And similarly, when we reflect on Hussein and our lives today, we've got to think Hussein didn't like that we mistreated and not respected as a human being. So it's important that we emulate what he stood for.
Despite the growth, some community leaders feel more work is needed to be done to support new converts. Shia Muslims currently make up about 15% of the estimated 3 million Muslims in Britain, with well over 100 mosques across the nation. Ensuring Imam Hussein's memory is being shared like never before. Robert Carter, London.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories says these attacks are illegal and irresponsible. The Israeli regime, however, says they are a preemptive act of self-defense against a Palestinian resistance movement called Islamic Jihad. The occupation forces say the bombardments could last a week, promising more deaths.
As the bodies pile high in the Gaza Strip, emergency protests like this are being held against the Zionist regime's latest onslaught. The pain and anguish is palpable, and with people who have loved ones braving the bombings right now, silence is just not an option.
Two Islamic Jihad commanders have reportedly been killed so far, as have dozens of men, women and children. Palestinians living outside the territories can only pray their loved ones are spared.
Yes, I have three of sisters and I have my mother in Gaza Strip. I'm trying all the time to contact with them, but they told me everything is bad in Gaza Strip. We're just scared. The children is very scared, crying all the time.
They don't know if they will live until, like, you know, night or not. They say, if we respond to your call, then you know we are fine. If we don't respond, you have to be scared and you have to call, like, you know, our relative and see if something happened to us.
The West's handling of the Palestinian crisis, juxtaposed with the support Ukraine is getting, has thrown into stark relief the lack of political will on the part of Western governments to heal this decades-old wound.
The Palestinian problem has been going on for decades, and yet it isn't told about in the main press. Our governments do not support it, neither the Tory party or Keir Starmer or any of them, not even Ed Davey, then none of them, of the Liberal Party, support what is going on. Why? Because it's more important to sell arms and to have some sort of democracy, they call it, in the Middle East. But what I think is happening is they're using Israel to create tension in the world.
Leave the Ukrainian with no armament whatsoever, because then if you give a gun to a Palestinian, he's a terrorist. But the Israelis can have all they like, and they are the victims.
The US has thrown its weight behind Israel, as has Britain. Both say Israel has a right to protect itself, but from what? More than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza have no freedom of movement, sitting ducks for the Israeli occupation forces. In preparation for the attacks, Tel Aviv prevented fuel deliveries to the already impoverished enclave. As a result, hospitals that are only allowed 4 hours of electricity a day will soon be unable to cope. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Voices of grief and sorrow for Imam Hussein, the third Shia imam, a man who lived 14 centuries ago, but continues to inspire Muslims. Every year during the first 10 days of the Muslim calendar month of Muharram, Iranians get together in large mourning processions to mark the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. He and his 72 companions were killed in 680 AD by the forces of the tyrannical ruler of the time, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, on the plains of the modern-day Iraqi city of Karbala.
After 14 centuries, we continue to love Imam Hussein, not only as our third Imam and the Prophet's grandson, but as the symbol of self-sacrifice and freedom-seeking.
Every year, we participate in the mourning rituals for Imam Hussein to keep his legacy alive. We dress in black, beat on our chests, and shed tears. The blazes of his love never die down in our hearts.
The ninth day of Muharram is called Tasua and is dedicated to Imam Hussein's half-brother, Abul Fazl al-Abbas, who fought alongside the Imam against the army of Yazid. Abul Fazl is highly revered among Muslims as a symbol of loyalty and chivalry.
Abul Fazl holds a special place in our hearts. In the Battle of Karbala, Imam Hussein and his household and their companions were denied access to Euphrates River to drink water, and it was Abul Fazl who fought a large group of the enemy's forces to get to the river, but on the way back, he was brutally killed by the forces of Yazid.
The Karbala tragedy was sparked after Imam Hussein refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, who was known as a corrupt ruler. These people say without the sacrifices of Imam Hussein, Islam as we know it could have been distorted by Yazid.
The reason Imam Hussein rose against Yazid was to tell his community that Yazid was not treading on the path of Islam. And by spilling the blood of Imam Hussein, who was the Prophet's son, Yazid revealed his anti-Muslim stance, and this ultimately led to the decline of his rule.
The climax of the Muharram rituals is the day of Ashura, which falls on the 10th day of the month. That's when large groups of Shia Muslims converge on Imam Hussein's shrine in the city of Karbala in Iraq to pay homage to him.
The event of Karbala is a heart-wrenching story that touches the heart of every listener. But these people say, aside from its tragic side, Imam Hussein's martyrdom is an endless source of lessons about freedom and resistance for all generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Scores of people were injured and many more were arrested after government forces attacked Muharram mourners in the Indian-controlled Kashmir's main city, Srinagar. Authorities had placed strict restrictions in the city and sealed the entry points with barbed wires to prevent Shia Muslims from participating in the traditional procession. On Saturday evening, authorities issued a statement upholding a ban on mourning processions in the city centre. Police and paramilitary forces were deployed in big numbers to maintain order. Mobile internet services were suspended in parts of Srinagar. However, some mourners defied restrictions and poured onto the streets at many places to mourn the martyrdom of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. The government forces swung into action and hit people with canes. A number of mourners were also detained.
3 decades on, the authorities continue to prevent Shia Muslims from holding traditional Muharram procession in the Regency Center, citing security reasons. The people here argue if the government can allow Hindu processions and political rallies in the heart of the city, why not Muharram procession?
See, on one hand, we see the whole security mechanism, you know, they get activated when Hindu pilgrimages are granted permissions and security arrangements are being made. But on the other hand, we see when, you know, something related to Muslims is there, they don't grant permissions. We don't want security at the first place. We want permission so that we could carry out our religious activities.
Very recently, ruling BJP party held a political rally in the city center. If authorities can ensure security for that rally, why are our peaceful morning processions banned? Why this discrimination?
2 major Muharram processions in the city center were banned by authorities following the outbreak of militancy in Kashmir in 1989. The authorities fear the processions could be taken advantage of by separatist groups to stoke anti-India sentiments and hence create security threats. The religious bodies, on the other hand, termed the ban as a brazen attack on their religious freedom.
Yes, entirely afsosnak baat hai.
It is very unfortunate that the authorities are selectively banning religious activities of the majority population here, shutting down mosques and banning processions, even as authorities claim the situation is improving in Kashmir. These days, annual Hindu pilgrimage is underway in Kashmir and all sorts of arrangements are being made to facilitate that. We strongly condemn discriminatory behavior of the government and hope that the good sense will prevail.
The religious bodies have also criticized the authorities for failing to make necessary arrangements, like ensuring availability of essential supplies. They say all promises and claims made by the authorities have fallen flat. Sidri Safib, Indian Administered Kashmir.
With her trip to Taiwan this week, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi set off a firestorm in offending China. From the self-governing territory, Pelosi criticized Beijing and its leadership, while carefully outlining the limitations of the U.S. commitment to defend the island.
In the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans are committed to the security of Taiwan in order to have Taiwan be able to most effectively defend themselves. But it also is about our shared values of democracy and freedom and how Taiwan has been an example to the world in that regard.
China had warned the U.S. and Pelosi against the visit, as it views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will one day rejoin a one China. In response to Pelosi's Taiwan visit, China's People's Liberation Army on Thursday began the largest military exercises targeting Taiwan in decades.
Tension in the situation across the Taiwan Strait is solely caused by the U.S. side. The root cause is Pelosi's selfish and willful interference with Taiwan, which seriously violates the One China principle. The Chinese government has the right to take all necessary and justified actions to firmly safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity.
In South Korea, Pelosi met with the Speaker of the National Assembly. Seoul has been careful to balance its U.S. military alliance and relations with its largest trading partner, China. Pelosi spoke with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol on the phone, but the two did not meet, an outcome widely viewed as a snub of the third-ranked U.S. official. House Speaker Pelosi later stopped in Japan, where she met with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. China later Friday announced sanctions against Pelosi and the suspension on several issues of cooperation with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Britain is on the brink of a recession, as deep as the 90s and as long as the 2008 financial crisis, a bleak projection by the country's central bank. The Bank of England says it's trying to stem skyrocketing prices by raising interest rates by half a point to 1.75%, saying the measure couldn't come soon enough.
If we don't bring inflation back to target, bearing in mind the huge scale of the energy shock we're seeing, if we don't bring it back to target, and if we get these so-called second-round effects entering in, it's going to get worse.
It was news that sent a chill among the public, people already feeling the squeeze on their finances.
Leaving out of my home and all the bills on, I have to pay it by myself. I'm on minimum wages as a cleaner. And, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do anyway.
The salary is still the same and the prices are going up, far too up. That's the reason what I have a concern about is.
The Bank of England predicts the economy is going to shrink, with recession starting this year and lasting all the way through the next. That plus the biggest decline in living standards on record and another sharp rise in household energy bills. The bank pins the eye-watering energy price hike largely on rising gas prices owing to the war in Ukraine. But there are other reasons.
It's a whole plethora of reasons coming together. So you can actually look at the effect of the pandemic, what that impacted on manufacturing and consumerability, global trade and supply chains, and the underlying cost of rising commodities, food and other areas. So this is a Gordian knot of elements coming together. Now, untie that knot, and that's what they're going to have trouble doing.
The writing had already been on the wall. Many experts did warn the UK was behind the curve in dealing with rising inflation. Britons are going to see their energy, fuel, and food bills increase significantly over the next year. Charities are warning of a catastrophe this winter. There's talk of creating warm spaces to provide heated sites for those unable to afford their energy bills.
This deluge of bad economic news comes as the country awaits a new prime minister, and that is a month away. But whoever they may be, their job has just become way harder. Cyprus is up London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has reached the 100-day mark of his second term, and the contrast with the bold newcomer of 2017 couldn't be more different. Macron is being described as distant, burnt out, weary, and hesitant, but the adjective he may like the least is powerless. 2 months into his new mandate, Macron experienced his worst failure as a politician. His young political party failed to win a parliamentary majority. A president used to ignoring the legislative branch so far hasn't shown much political skill or interest in the tough work of cobbling together successful majorities to get his policies approved. Many believe Macron may call for new elections as early as this year or rule even more often by executive decree. Both options are sure to create major opposition in a new parliament as well as social unrest.
Since the legislative elections, France is in a new political era dominated by uncertainty. Macron has been acting as if he can easily find a majority in Parliament on a bill-by-bill basis, but I think that has very little chance to work. It's very likely that in less than a year he'll dissolve Parliament and call for new legislative elections.
Polls show that, unlike most winners of presidential elections, Macron has not benefited from the usual honeymoon or grace period. Just like in 2017, Macron was mainly elected to block the far right. But he's no longer a political unknown without a track record. Instead, he's a polarizing figure who has been tarnished worldwide by his authoritarian repression of the Yellow Vest protest movement, and who is perceived domestically as wanting very different things than the average person. Economic stagnation is already upon the Eurozone, and depression could be next. Political stagnation appears to have taken root in France, with perhaps even a depressed president. 100 days into Macron's second term, it's a summer of silent discontent in France, with possibly explosive autumn unrest looming. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the sacrifices that the Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam presented to establish a life of honor. Thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. I'm your host Hussein Suleiman, and in today's lesson, we are talking about the sacrifices that Al-Imam Hussein made and presented in order for him to establish a life of honor, in order for him to be a prominent person in the history of Islam. Now, Hussein's message was so victorious. And whenever Hussein used to speak, whenever Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam used to speak with his companions, he made sure that the message that he was passing through was the same message that is the same message that he's aiming at reaching his followers, his companions. So he wasn't just talking to his companions. He was talking to his companions, but at the same time, he was passing message to all the people at the time that they were living, who are following him as a leader. On the day of Ashura, truth was exalted in the field of values, you know, that created discrimination about loyalty. Now, the sincerity and the selflessness, and this day was not restricted to Muslims or a particular group. You know, it is related to all the communities of the world. So when Imam Hussein was talking to his Sahabas, he was talking to the whole world. He was talking to all the communities, to all the Muslims who were believing in Islam at the time and even in today's Islam. Now, through these words, people could gain inspiration and perception about the whole situation of how to live against slavery, how to stand against oppression from the tyrant rulers. Now, Imam Hussein, one of the many traits that made him stand out as a figure of honor, made him stand out as a prominent leader, as a reformer, is that he did his best to pass his knowledge, to pass through his good words, to talk to his, you know, companions, and from it to gain, you know, to gain the audience from the Muslims, from the people and the whole world at large. Because from his words, the whole world learned who Imam Hussein was.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, we are talking about the main sacrifices that Al-Imam Al-Hussein presented to establish a life of honor. Now, one of the sacrifices was that Imam Hussein made sure that he's standing against the oppression. He's standing against the evil that was happening at the time. He stood to speak against the tyrants, the bad tyrants of the time, the Umayyad, you know, the Umayyad leaders, the Umayyad caliphates of the time. He stood to speak against them and to say whatever he felt was not right. He said that this was not right. And this particular message, he was saying it to his companions, but at the same time, he was raising an awareness. He was passing a message to the whole world. He was passing a message to the Muslims of the world. He was passing a message to the followers of Ahlul Bayt and the followers of his grandfather, Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. In this way, Hussein's message, Imam Hussein alayhi salam's message, became victorious. And along with his companions, he became the first standard bearer of truth and justice among the people, such that more astounding success is not found anywhere else. You could not find such a success that Imam Hussein gained in any other particular era that any leader lived during that era. Now, the day of Ashura had not yet reached its tragic end when people became attentive to its event and factors. Now, this incident bestowed such honor to Islam that even writers having opposing views had to acknowledge its importance. And everyone else in this world right now is acknowledging the importance of the tragedy of Karbala, of the tragedy of Ashura. The chief factor was that it became the most well-known event in the human history. One of the things that made Al-Imam Hussein to become successful is that he stood against the oppression and he stood by speaking his mind, standing against the tyrant rulers.